Hi, I'm Bill Zack, East Coast Architect Evangelist with Microsoft's Developer and Platform Evangelism. My focus is primarily the New York metropolitan area, where I spend a lot of my time working with various developer and architect groups. The following presentation was recorded live on July 17, 2008, at the NewYorkCity.NET Developers Group. The subject of the presentation, Visual Studio 2008 .NET 3.5 Service Pack 1, was delivered by Shankun Yogi and Sam Gazit. Shankun is a product unit manager for the .NET framework and reports directly to Scott Guthrie in Redmond. Sam Gazit is a technical product manager, also from Redmond. The video that you're about to see was streamed live to the internet for user group members who could not attend the meeting. Recording and streaming was done by Chuck Boyce, a local Microsoft Digital Media MVP, via his website, .netdev.com. And now, our feature presentation.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out. I'm Shankun Yogi. I'm a product unit manager with .NET Framework, so I'm actually on Scott Guthrie's team. I run a team. There's kind of several teams within the .NET developer platform, and I run a team called the UIFX team, which basically is responsible for ASP.NET, which hopefully some of you have heard of, the Windows Forms, as well as some new technologies that we're doing on top of Silverlight and WPF. So we kind of focus more on the developer productivity and kind of programming model side of the experience. Sam?
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Come on, I have to hear more than that. There we go. All right, you guys are live. Good. So I heard I'm Sam Gazit. I'm a marketing guy in developer marketing. And before you start, you know, kind of writing me off, I'll be doing a demo today of some of the stuff that he's going to mention. But I'm glad that you guys were able to make it out. I've heard from a gentleman up at the front that he's not going to the Bahamas. Instead, he's come here to listen to us. So there's a ton of pressure. So we want to make it worth your while. So if you guys have any questions, or if you guys have any ideas or thoughts, you know, we'll try to make it as interactive as we can.
Yeah, if you have any questions at any time, just feel free to... might want to raise your hand first, but just feel free to speak up. So we wanted to actually get a sense before we started, because we're going to talk a lot about this 3.5 SP1 and 2008 SP1 thing. How many people have actually seen this or downloaded it or tried it out?
Oh, there's someone.
There you go.
Raise them high. Come on, let's see them. I saw two. Can we do better than two? Okay. Three. Okay.
Excellent. How many of you have tried 2008 and 3.5? There we go. That sounds just right.
Perfect.
Excellent. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about kind of what were the kind of key problems we're looking at in general, and then spend most of our time kind of focusing on this SP1 release. And then Sam's going to do a demo and kind of walks us through some of the key features in that. So I wanted to start, though, because I don't get an opportunity to come in, come up this far, usually. A lot of people often ask me, kind of, what's my job as product unit manager look like, working on the .NET framework. I like to kind of give them a picture that it's a little bit like this, although at times it's a little bit more like this. But seriously, it's a great thing, kind of working on the .NET framework, working on the developer technologies from Microsoft, and also kind of working with customers such as yourself. I think one of the things that we really love is that, you know, the people that we work with are developers like us, and so being able to kind of get that feedback and kind of connect with you directly is something that we really appreciate. So what's kind of keeping us busy? There are a few kind of things that right now and kind of place at the top of, from the .NET platform perspective, what we think are kind of our key themes. The first is this theme of differentiated end user experiences. So, and you've kind of seen this start with ASP.NET Ajax and WPF and carry on through with things like Silverlight. It's the idea that really design kind of matters, and that you know, we want to enable not just developer experiences are in terms of building applications, but the end user experiences that you can kind of go and build. And this means that as we're kind of building our platform, we also need to think about the end user experience. And a lot of this is about UI, but you'll see as we talk about things like SP1, it also goes to things like the way, what users have to put up with when they're actually installing applications. And the stuff that we've done with the client profile is really kind of geared towards that. I just ripped something. Is everything there still working? At the same time, we're kind of really looking at the developer experience, and a big part of that is really that we're seeing that the way developers are actually building applications is rapidly maturing. How many of you out there are in the apps you're building are building unit tests? See, if you ask this same question a couple of years ago, you get like maybe one or two people raise their hands. A lot of people would be saying, what are unit tests? And we're seeing this kind of grow very rapidly. And we have developers that understand things like test-driven development. They understand, what are the right patterns for reuse. There's a lot more kind of focus around building application around the right architectures. And so we've really started looking, I think, from a .NET perspective in terms of how do we go and enable those right patterns so that people can develop apps the right way and kind of manage and evolve them over time. And a big part of that is also kind of how do they work with data. So if you're building business apps, chances are you're working with data a lot. And so a big part of what we're looking at is really kind of raising the abstractions on data, being able to have, take the things that you do with data, like caching and query, and be able to package them as nice pieces of functionality that are well integrated with the rest of the framework. So what we did with Link in 2008 and 3.5 was kind of the first of those. And you'll see in 3.5 SP1, we've actually started adding more of those. It also means kind of being able to use the data models to actually drive your user interfaces so that you don't have to go and write a lot of code that kind of duplicates your data-driven functionality in your UI tier. And you'll see some of that. And then in terms of actually working on the web, so as you're turning your applications into services, how do you make that data available as services in a nice way? So we're kind of looking at that. At the same time, we're also continuing working on the core. We have this, one of the teams, my peer product unit, the CLR product unit, this is actually all they do. They spend a lot of time making the core better and better. We also spend a significant amount of our time doing that. So that includes things like startup time, working set, performance improvements, kind of going and looking at the platform level. It also means on the server, kind of pushing the bounds on the scalability of our services and of ASP.NET. It also means looking at kind of new CPU advances and things like 64-bit multi-core. I was talking earlier today about the Parallel SDK, Tools SDK. That's kind of a effort that we've kind of started up. And then around deployment, that's another kind of key area that we think is going to be a place where by making the work of getting our framework easier, that we can drive kind of the next generation of applications. How many of you think that it's a pain to deploy the .NET framework on the client today? Anyone build .NET client applications? We're starting with SP1. We're actually taking some steps to make that significantly easier. And then architectural improvements, versioning, add-in security. These are typically harder to do in a service pack, so I won't talk as much today about that. But we're continuing to kind of look at those things as part of the CLR, and over the next few months you'll hear more about that. And then the final thing I think for us is we've kind of built this .NET framework thing, and the key thing that we think is the value of that is that we built this programming model, this set of tools, a set of languages that kind of span across our entire continuum. So we started with the web with ASP.NET and IIS, and with IIS 7 we've actually done some work to really kind of integrate the programming model together between those two. On the desktop, we've got WPF, we've got .NET for Office developers, and then, you know, more recently, we've added a third thing into that for kind of media, RIA, and then for devices by adding Silverlight as some a way that, that, again, people can kind of go and use that .NET knowledge and the .NET framework to go build rich internet applications and media-driven applications. And then around that, we then kind of have this consistent set of tools. You know, Visual Studio we've had for a while. Expression is kind of our new line that we're investing in quite a bit to then bring the designers into that mix and really have that, you know, .NET continuum also spread across you know, those two roles in the organization. How many of you use Expression today? What do you think of it overall? Anyone?
I like the style sheet support in Expression Web. It's fantastic.
We actually, one of the things that we did was to actually, you know, make it provide the same designer surface across both Expression and Visual Studio so that, you know, the a lot of the style sheet designer stuff we've actually taken back into Visual Studio so that developers can kind of do that. And that, again, it's kind of part of our trying to build that nice continuum. And the fact that, you know, you can start with a project in Expression as a designer, you can go hand it off to a developer or the other way around, and then you can keep kind of evolving that and kind of keep that under the same project. We think that that's a pretty key value proposition for people using our stuff. All right, so not your grandmother's SP1. I think as we talked about earlier, and an SP1 or in a service pack in general, you see the typical kinds of things we do, right? We do lots of bug fixes, we do lots of performance improvements, we go take customer feedback, we do some DCRs based on that. We try to keep a high degree of compatibility. Usually we get in trouble for breaking a couple of things here and there. But that's your kind of typical definition of an SP1. With what we've done, so all that we've done in SP1, and hopefully not breaking any of you, but in addition to that, one of the things that we've kind of done, looking at the set of things that I was talking about earlier, is really kind of go and take this as an opportunity to go take some of the features that we've been working on independently and actually put them into the framework. So a lot of the new features that you're going to see in SP1, they all started out as independent features. And we had, you know, CTPs and out-of-band previews of things like Astoria, Dynamic Data, we used to call it Oryx a while ago. And that's great that we kind of got that kind of feedback. We got people to try it. But one of the things that folks have been telling us a lot is you know, you've got this huge list of things to keep track of in terms of all the things coming out of Redmond. And so one of the things that we did was to say, hey, let's actually use SP1 as an opportunity to kind of go put those into the framework and tools, to integrate them together so that the different features work really well together and kind of use it as a forcing function for the different buildings in Redmond to talk to each other a little more. And then also out of that kind of have a really good level of tool integration to bring the tools into alignment with that. So I've got some detailed slides on it, but I think the best way to kind of actually start it is to have Sam come up and do a demo of the key features in SP1.
Okay. Thanks, Shanku. So how many guys are building... How many of you guys are building websites today? By show of hands. All right. How many guys are using data in your applications? So lots of you, right? It makes sense. So hopefully what I'm going to show you today is going to be incredibly beneficial for you. What we think is that this is going to enable you to focus on things that are a little bit more critical to the apps that you're driving, things that you have kind of domain expertise over, and we're going to take care of a lot of the plumbing type code for you. So in this demo, I'd like to run through dynamic data, I'd like to run through ADO.NET data services, and finally talk about how we consume those things on the client. But as I do this, I want to hit on three key points, and that is, as Shanku said, that we're modernizing applications. We're enabling developers to very, very quickly build data-driven applications. And finally, we're really focusing on the art of rapid application deployment. That is, if you think about a developer running a marathon, You know, the first 16 miles is building that application. That last mile, that last really critical, you know, push to the finish line has been a little bit tough in the past. And so by reducing the size of the, you know, the redistributable of the framework, we're hoping that's going to make things a lot better. So I had this demo cooked up. We're going on this kind of press tour and showing it to some press folks. And, you know, I heard that, you know, while it's good at kind of showing, you know, a few of these things, really these guys are developers at the user group meeting. They want to see you go from file new. They want to see you write some code. So here you're going to see a marketing guy try to tap dance and write more code than he's written in his entire life. So we'll give it a shot. We'll start from file new here. First thing I'd like to do is I'd like to build a data-driven website using ASP.NET Dynamic Data. So I'll go File New. I'll pick a project here. And I'm going to select a Dynamic Data Entities Web Application. Now, there are two templates here for Dynamic Data. I'm going to pick the one that's related to the ADO.NET Entity Framework, which I'll use. And I'll call this thing Northwind Dynamic Data. I'll hit OK. So this is a brand new dynamic data template. Before we dive into kind of creating the site and integrating our data here, I want to kind of run through the anatomy of this site and this template as it exists now. So you've got the things that you're kind of used to, a global file, some styling, master template there. We've also got this dynamic data folder. Now this thing has kind of the magic of ASP.NET Dynamic Data. It's got a few page templates, namely delete, edit, insert, and list, and this list details thing. These are actually the templates that are going to be attaching to your data model, and they're going to be used to surface all of your entities here. So these are really key things. The next piece here is a set of field templates. And these are the templates that are used to render based on a data type. So we have a user control template for Booleans, one for date times, and so on and so on. And so you can see, or kind of right off the bat, that you have a pretty good degree of customization at your fingertips.
So Sam, if I understand ASPX and ACX files, do I understand field templates and page
yes.
templates?
Yeah, field templates are nothing more than ASCX files. And we can jump into one of those to take a look. And you can see here it's pretty straightforward. We've got a data-bound control view. So.
Can I make you set your font size higher?
Yeah, that's true. Oh, that's, my goodness.
That's half my job, is to bug presenters and make
them go out
to 14 and loosen it up.
Yeah, Solus is great. All right, so first strike against the marketing guy. Who's keeping track? All right, we'll go 14. Yeah, and the resolution's probably not so great. On Solus, a nice little fixed-width font. Okay. Beautiful. How's that look? A little better?
Yeah.
All right. I won't strain you guys tonight. Okay, so let's actually get started here. The first thing we want to do is we want to add a data model to our site. So I'll do that by saying add a new item. And I'll select an ADO.NET entity data model here. And I'll call this thing Northwind Data Model. And I'll hit add here. As I do that, Visual Studio is going to open up the entity data model wizard. Is it? Oh, Visual Studio. Yeah. So, basically, I need to select a database. Now, I have here an instance of SQL Express running on my local machine that I'm going to connect to. The important thing to point out here, though, is that this is SQL Server 2008. This is the first time that we've had tooling support in Visual Studio and the framework as well for SQL Server 2008. So, as a developer, I get to make use of all the new data types and all the great things in SQL Server. So I'm happy with the rest of the default settings there. I'll hit OK. Now here, if you're familiar with the link to SQL Designer, this should be actually pretty familiar to you. Here I get to select either tables or views or stored procedures out of my database. And these are the things that are going to be surfaced in my data model. So for the sake of the demo, I'll pick all my tables, and I'll leave the rest of that stuff default. And so now Visual Studio is going to open up the ADO.NET Entity Framework Designer. I'll kind of maximize here. Let's give us a little bit more workspace. Okay, so you can see that we already have a set of mappings that map our tables in our database to entities. Now, if you notice here, I have a customer entity. Well, what does that mean? I had a customer table in my database, and I have a set of properties that map back to the fields in that database, and a set of navigation properties that show the foreign key relationship. So essentially, Visual Studio has not only inferred the schema of my tables, but also the relationship between tables. Right. Now I have this nice little object-oriented model that I can play with, and I get all the things that I like as a developer. I get syntax highlighting and debugging.
Can you do this with any database, or just SQL Server?
So the Entity Framework is a pluggable model. Here I'm doing it against SQL Server, but you should be able to do it with any database.
And we're actually working with Oracle and IBM and a couple of other database partners to actually have providers for Entity Framework for those databases. But it's also an open provider model, so you can go ahead and write your own providers
But the mere ADO.NET provider is not sufficient, right? There needs to be an Entity Framework provider.
Yeah, the Entity Framework, I mean, the way to kind of look at that is the Entity Framework kind of works at a higher level of abstraction, and so the provider that you need to work with kind of need to know about that abstraction. I think there was a hand in the back, or no?
Available for currently for MySQL?
I believe there's a MySQL provider we're working with as well. We're working with a partner on that.
Okay, so let me jump back here. Now, one thing to note is that I can actually see all my data model. But luckily, I'm able to zoom in and zoom out here. So I got this kind of nice little designer, and I can go away. And I can look at a rich thumbnail view here. I can slide in, slide out. Now, if I'm not happy with the way that the framework has done my mappings here, I can actually customize a little further. So notice that I have, for example, a varchar company name that's been converted into a company name. If I wanted to, I could edit that even further and kind of customize it in my own way. But I'm pretty happy with the defaults. So I'm going to jump back to my website here, and I want to hook these things together. So in order to do that, I've got my data model set up. I just need to jump into my global file here and simply go down and uncomment a line that was in the template already. So I'll just uncomment here. Then I need to specify the type of the data contents, and that happens to be Northwind Entities. I just created it.
So Sam, what is that file you're editing?
This is the global ASX file. You should be familiar with this file. It's kind of core to building websites.
So one of the things that you'll notice in here is that there are a set of routes defined. So what we have now in ASP.1 is this routing engine, the ASP.NET routing engine, that will let you kind of go ahead and create human-readable, human-typable, search engine optimizable URLs for your ASP.NET application. So they're no longer kind of question mark, ASPX, blah, 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 blah. Now you can go ahead and create URLs that make sense. We're actually going to use that routing engine also for the MVC framework. That's going to come out after, on top of SP1. And the routing engine is used in dynamic data to give you URLs that fit nicely with the data model that you're actually exposing.
Is that a response handler on the
service? Yeah, it basically works as a module that will kind of go in. And what it does is it's a completely pluggable thing. So you can basically put in your own route implementations.
Oh, okay.
And so dynamic data actually does something where it will go and look at the data model based on that, go figure out the routes that are needed. And you can, in MVC, you can go create and customize your routes anyway. You can hook them up to, like an IOC container if you want to use that to kind of discover what set of URLs you have available. It's a very pluggable thing.
You're stealing my thunder.
Can we make one more micro managerial request? Can
yes.
you just hit view and full screen on your menu?
Absolutely.
When you're showing code?
Okay. All right. That's a great suggestion. I'll jump into routes in just a second. But before I do that, I'll need to set scaffolding to true.
I have so little thunder. Please don't steal it.
So I set scaffolding to true. Now, this is just a demo, so I'm scaffolding all my tables. In practice, you probably want to be very selective on which tables you expose on your website, of course. But that's kind of all I need to do. And once I do that, full screen. Oops. Let me jump out of full screen. Once I do that, now I'm able to just fire up my website, and I should be good to go. So I'll hit play. Yes, I'd like to modify WebKit. Let's slowly but surely. Aha! My very first dynamic data set. Now, here's the point. I haven't written a single line of code, but I have all of the tables in my database exposed now for me to go play with. Not only do I have the data in these tables, I also have the relationship between these tables. So a categories table is related to a products table. Well, dynamic data is smart enough to go realize that relationship and let me kind of bounce back and forth between those things. And I have the kind of CRUD operations here, create, edit, update, delete. I can edit some data. You've noticed that I've actually changed it to Sam. It's because I was playing with it earlier. But I can hit update here and can update my database directly.
You noticed it actually, the fields that were kind of relations to a list of items, it actually took those and turned those into combo boxes. So you didn't actually have to type your category.
Yeah, and the same thing here. Like if I want to filter in any way, I mean, these are all the categories that are being pulled from my database. So it's actually pretty intelligent here. It's built a pretty intelligent site.
Reporting services, right? It's very similar to it.
Pardon?
It's very similar to a reporting services.
Yeah.
You haven't met Charles before.
We met. I mean, reporting services is a little more focused on kind of aggregating data, where this is kind of more focused on letting you navigate over and edit data.
Okay. Yep. Question then?
What does an entity provider give you that a database provider doesn't give you?
Okay, so the question is, why are we, if I understand it correctly, why are we using this entity framework thing? Why can't we just go directly against the database, right? The answer is that your entity model actually can evolve independent of your database. And the fact is you can, and I'll show this in just a second, you can associate some metadata with this data model. And dynamic data will actually look at this data model, look at your metadata, and build your presentation layer accordingly, right? So you can actually encode some business logic, if you will, some validation rules in your data model, and those things are picked up by dynamic data.
And with the entity framework, you can actually specify some pretty complex mappings. You can use things like inheritance. You can actually combine tables into a type. You can actually go ahead and create complex types. So if you have two columns in your database that you want to treat as an address, you can kind of go do that. And then this layer basically goes and picks up that domain model rather than working against the database directly. Dynamic data is completely pluggable, so if you wanted to make it work directly against a database, you theoretically could, and we actually have third parties that are making dynamic data work against their own data frameworks, but the entity framework gives you one alternative for defining your app domain model that you want to build this app to.
It does work against linked to SQL as well.
It works against linked to SQL as well.
Correct.
And the choice between that, linked to SQL gives you more of a, more of an ability to get a CLR object model against the tables in your database. And for that, it's really well optimized. Whereas the entity framework kind of gives you a little bit more flexibility in terms of being able to do more complex mappings, and also gives you the provider model so that you can work against multiple databases. But dynamic data will work against both.
Yes, one question.
So does this support doing customized views configurable from the object rather than actually pulling the views back from the database directly?
So this is actually going against the entity object model. So and I think you've got something where you're going to modify that model, right?
So I'm going to modify that object model. But yeah, you could pull in views into your data model, and then you're going against those views as opposed to going to the views in your database, if that makes sense. So we're just raising everything one level of abstraction, essentially. And the nice thing is it's object-oriented, so you get all those great productivity. Yes?
Does the scaffolding move out of the box many-to-many relationships? Or create a UI for many-to-many?
I believe it does not.
I assume all this is customizable.
It is customizable.
Scaffolding.
Yeah, what we've actually found so far is a lot of customers have actually preferred to stay within the scaffolding framework and go and add additional metadata, and it's actually really pluggable in that sense.
How much of a performance hit is all this, or is that not really an appropriate question at this point?
We found, the large part of the performance hit tends to come from the when on a web server tends to come from being IO bound.
And so that kind of comes from the database end. You can actually use all of the caching semantics with this to kind of go cache at the...
So as long as you're using appropriate tricks and tools.
Now, this is also layered at two levels. So if you want to use kind of the APIs to discover the metadata, but then you want to use a completely different presentation tier, you can actually do that. And if you go to our CodePlex site for ASP.NET, we've actually got a version of dynamic data working with MVC, where you can basically plug in a dynamic controller and point it to an object, and it will automatically generate a bunch of verbs for that object. And that actually doesn't use any of the WebForms framework, but it uses the lower level parts of dynamic data to kind of go and infer all of that information from the metadata.
Okay, so no more questions. We'll kind of keep chugging along here. One thing to notice is that the URL structure, as mentioned before, is it's pretty generic here. I've got an entity, and then I've got one of my templates here. And if I click on edit, for example, you'll see that route changes to entity, and then the action, or edit in this case, and it's pulling up the edit template. Now I can actually customize that if I jump into my global file here. I'll go into full screen. So you notice that I have this default route here, and that's essentially what we're doing. We're saying table name or entity name slash action, where the set of constraints are on the action are list, details, edit, insert. Those are the four templates that I showed. But in fact, we have that fifth template, and we can make use of that one to provide inline editing. So I'll just Alt-Shift. I wish I knew the keyboard shortcut. It's Alt-Shift-Enter. Okay, so I'll just comment this guy out and comment these guys in. And now we can see that we have a new set of routes. In this case, we're going to use the entity name and then the list details template. That's the last one here. And this one does both my my editing and my listing at the same time. So I have both list actions and details actions. So I'll hit play. Now, instead of when I click on a given table here, instead of having the edit view on a separate page, when I hit edit here, you'll notice I now have this nice inline editing capability, which is really nice. And in fact, you can take this template and you can customize it even further, which I'll show a little bit later on. But this is a good example of using routes here. Now, I could do something kind of interesting. What I could do is a combination of both. So for example, let's grab this route. And these things are kind of executed in the same order that they're registered. So I'll put this one underneath. And then I can specify for a given table, instead of just generic table, I can say products. And so this particular template will only be applied to the products table. And I'll just add, oops.
Is that the database table or the entity?
This is the entity table. Yeah, everything I'm doing, I'm doing against the entity model here. Oops.
Yeah, so don't take the word table too early.
Yeah, sorry.
It's just the syntax.
Okay. So now, let's fire it up again. Hopefully, what we should see is that we have these two different options in the same application. So if we go to shippers, for example, you've got the kind of two-page editing. But if you go to products, you've got inline editing. So you can do both at the same time, which is kind of nice. And you can customize it even further to create your own custom routes.
Can we take a look at one of the template files?
Yeah, absolutely. There's really not much going on there. I mean, it's kind of what you would probably imagine. You've got an update panel for doing the Ajax kind of stuff. You've basically got a grid view here. And you've also got a data source here. This is an entity data source controller. And essentially, we're just kind of doing the binding logic for you.
So a couple of things, if you're familiar with 3.5, a couple of things that are new there that you'll see. One of the things is the entity data source I mentioned. So if you're familiar with linked data source, there's really a link to SQL data source. So we've got an entity data source now in 3.5 SP1 for letting you work with linked entities. And then our core controls, things like data grid and so on, We've actually made those work with dynamic data by adding an interface to the framework that you and your custom controls can basically implement. And when you actually implement those interfaces, dynamic data will then work with those controls to feed them the right metadata needed to generate the right columns or whatever. And then we have things like the dynamic validator will actually go and look at the metadata on the model and use that to apply model-driven validation rather than have to specify validation rules in your UI.
Yeah, let's take a look at that, actually. It's a pretty good segue. So if we jump back to, let's see what we can do. Let's start by, let's do this. Let's add a new class to our application. And a key point here is that the entity framework is actually implemented as partial classes. Are you guys familiar with partial classes?
Yeah. Okay,
great. So what I can do here is I can actually start adding some metadata back to my entity model. I can say public partial class employees. So if I, as you might imagine, if I kind of go to the definition here, there we get our menu back. Right, you'll see that it's defined in two places. It's defined here kind of under the covers for me in the code that's generated by the data model designer. And it's also defined in my own custom class. And so what I can do is I can actually annotate my part of this class by using the component model namespace. Data annotations. Now notice that this is actually not in the system web. It's actually in system component model, which kind of speaks to our broader vision of using annotation even outside of the web. Most of these things you're seeing today are in fact building blocks towards the technologies that we're shipping in the future. So I simply say scaffold table set to false. I add this thing to my data model, and then sure enough, when I fire up my website, you'll see the employees table is now gone. It's been hidden. Right? And the key thing here that I'll keep driving home is I haven't touched the presentation yet. I've only been working with my entity framework data model here, which is kind of a very powerful thing. So not only can I do that for tables, I can also do that on the column level. So if I grab products, for example, you can see that I'm doing something similar. It's a little bit different. Essentially, I've said for this particular class, products, there's a metadata type called products metadata. And then I've set on the column level, scaffold column to false.
So for those of you who know partial classes, do you know why we did it this way? Quick quiz?
Yeah, so you can regenerate.
That's part of it. The other thing is we actually, so doing partials overall lets us kind of make these changes without having to deal with the data model and lets us lets the entity model regenerate this. In the case of this one, we actually today don't have partial attributes on properties, and so that's why you have to specify a separate class and basically point it back to your products class and basically say, this class is basically providing metadata back to the products class.
So here I've gone and I probably should have shown this before I turned it off, but I've gone and turned off the reorder. In fact, let me do this. Let me comment this guy out so we can actually see what we're doing here. Fire up our website again, and we'll go into products, and we'll see reorder level column here. Now, the key is that if this column were to appear in other places, for example, if I clicked on the details view for this thing, the change that I make to the data model will be reflected in both places. So then when I comment this thing back in, I will see that has now disappeared. Give it a second. Okay, so no more reorder level. It's kind of a nice thing. So I have control over what tables are displayed, what columns are displayed.
What about you're using the same template for for your different tables, and if you wanted, I assume if you really want to customize things, you would pull them out and make them separate.
Yep. So I'm gonna show an example of how we can customize a template on an entity level. If that's helpful.
And the interesting thing to know here is, we've got a set of built-in attributes, but this is a completely extensible system. So what we've seen is a lot of people have actually they're adding their own metadata attributes, and then in their templates, they're actually picking them up. So it's a nice pattern for being able to do this data-driven UI, but you can go ahead, and so we've had people come in
you know, create attributes for reordering columns, for example.
So, for example, if you wanted to change the title of a column, you would do that with metadata on the data side?
Now, in that case, we've actually got a built-in one.
Right.
But if you wanted to add a, you know, a help text or something that pops up in the corner of the screen, you would basically go add that metadata, and then you would, to your page template, you would go add that control and pick that metadata up.
Yes, question.
Is there anything for triggering data changes on elements within a table, for instance? So, say, I'm just thinking of a traditional model where you'll have a series of drop-downs.
Yep.
Each drop-down obviously adjusts the data in
right.
each of the ones after.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a pretty rich eventing model, and I'll show how we can hook into one of these events to actually write some code based on, you know, when an update happens or kind of as these things are going on. So let me do something really quickly here that's actually kind of interesting. I'll jump back to, let's see, in products. What I can do is copy this here. But instead of saying scaffold column, I think, actually, let me just grab the column. It's probably better to show what I'm about to hide before I actually do it. So in products, for example, I've got this column called units on order, for example. And if I happen to know something about this particular column, I happen to know some business logic, like there can be no more than 100 units on order, I can encode that in my data model. So instead of reorder level, I'll say units on order. Units on order. And instead of scaffold column, I'll say, say range from 0 to 100. So anytime we have this particular field, that validation will be applied to that field. So let's jump back and let's go to products. And now what happens if I try to edit this row and I make this more than, say, make this 500, I hit update, I get this nice little validation error that says, oh, nope, you're wrong, it has to be between 0 and 100.
So this is also totally pluggable. There's a set of validation rules that it gets from the database itself. So when you point the entity framework at a database, it will pick up things like required fields, and those will get validated automatically. This lets you kind of do, we provide a built-in set of attributes that let you do like range validation and things like that, but then you can write your own validation attributes, including programmatic validation, and those things will get picked up and reflected in the UI. But the key thing is you're never having to actually put validation logic in your UI. So as you go and update your validation logic, your UI logic stays consistent.
Yes.
On a pluggable note, you were talking before about how really all these things are pluggable, and so non-Microsoft controls could hook into this. So
yes.
On ASP.NET, you have a whole series of screencasts that Scott Hanselman did,
yep.
which are remarkably similar to these demos.
I'm a marketing guy, leave me alone.
No, that's not even my point, but it's good for everyone else to know that they can
see. I want an apology, hold on.
But in a couple of his demos, he's using some third-party controls from Telerik.
Yes, I'm going to do that as well.
Okay, is that, well then with the, I don't want to step on your punchline too much.
Did they
implement some of these interfaces that you were talking about? Yep. Is that why their controls work, or will any custom, current third-party ASP.NET controls?
So you can use, for the UI in your form, you can use any existing ASP.NET controls. And many of our controls we actually made no changes to, like the labels and text boxes, for example. Where you need, and so when you write these field templates, which Sam's going to show, a lot of the custom logic goes in there. The place where you need custom controls is like, let's say I have a grid view, and I tell the grid view, instead of giving it a set of rows, I say, go render this entity. And it's got to go look at that entity's model to figure out which columns to show, which things to show as drop-downs, which things to show as links, and that piece of logic is something that those complex controls would have to implement.
Okay, and the simple controls.
Yeah, so Telerik, like for their super duper grid view, they've gone and kind of implemented this interface, and then we just feed them all the metadata.
But for their calendar control or their spinner controls, those would probably work unchanged.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to show them working in just a second. So
yeah.
Thank you.
I just want to know that you talked about the validations and setting up rules on the data model. What kind of feedback you're getting in terms of people using like business rule engine would incorporate, so like, you know, the business user can change the rules. Yep.
So as you guessed, kind of when you're building directly against the entity framework, you're kind of a little bit on your own in terms of how you encode those rules. And the idea is, you know, if you can write C#, you can write them. If you have a higher level, like a rules engine or something that's providing this stuff, what you basically have to do is plug in at the dynamic data's provider layer, where really that you have to write a provider that lets that rules engine provide the right metadata for dynamic data to kind of work against. And so it's basically just mapping, you know, if you've got some other rule system or, you know, any other system that's kind of got its own business logic, you have to have, it's essentially a type descriptor kind of layer that lets you kind of go and take that metadata and express it in a way that the CLR can understand it. And then dynamic data will work with that. And we're now doing that, where people are actually building internally within Microsoft, they're actually building taking dynamic data and building providers for some of the new stuff that we're doing. You may have heard Oslo and, you know, names like that. We're now looking at kind of how dynamic data works with those.
Yes?
These attributes, like how smart is it? Like the hiding a column, is that just hiding in the UI, or is that not pulling that data anymore?
So when I reuse this data model in other places, I mean, that piece of data, metadata is associated. So it's not just in this particular presentation layer, but any presentation layer, you know, picks up the same data model. So
In this case, for the data grid, it actually didn't generate a column. So as soon as it sees a field, it sees that metadata, it goes ahead and skips that column when it's generating its columns.
Okay. So one of the, you know, kind of harder things that...
Do you get it from the database, though?
Sorry?
Pardon?
You get the data from the database?
It ultimately gets the data from the database, but the metadata, it gets some of it from the database. So
selects that column.
So that's what dynamic data does, which is dynamic data looks at, whether it's the entity model or linked to SQL, looks at the classes, it goes and gathers together the class type information, it goes and gathers together all the relationship information, and then all the metadata that you've annotated, and then it packages all that up, goes and does some work on that, and then goes and feeds it to the UI tier to go and say, to these dynamic controls, to go and say, hey, here's what I've learned about this entity model, now go generate me a UI off that.
And so if your UI tier is a client app, for example, you can still make use of some of these things, which is kind of nice. So the last thing that I wanted to do in terms of customizing is just add a new folder here. This is going to take just a bit of time. But the idea here is that I want to be able to add another column to my products table that lets me visualize pictures. So if we jump into the Server Explorer here, and we look at the categories table, for example, you'll notice that we have this picture field, and we've got some embedded images. So I want to be able to pull those into my data model as well. So quickly here, I'll try to do this as quickly as I can. I'll just copy some. Now these are the user controls that we talked about before. And a little bit of a kind of link here to make this work. You know, there's some conversion required from going from an embedded database image to a bitmap, but I'll kind of spare you the details. That in there. We'll take these two controls and we'll just drag and drop them into our field templates here. Like so. Oops. And then we need to go back and add a line to our web config. So let's jump into our config file here. We'll go to the HTTP handlers and let's add one quick line here, which I have in my cheat sheet. And lastly, the last thing I need to do here is just do a quick find and replace.
So the handlers create an image on the handler level prior to it, and then making the image available to the actual data.
Sorry?
That's actually creating a .NET image object?
Yes.
Yeah, that handler, I think there's sample code for that out there somewhere. All it is given some ID, it goes and pulls an image data out of a database and goes and turns it into a JPEG image and then sends it out over the response wire.
So I was waiting to ask this question, I might as well ask it now. You're obviously handling the block for the image there. What about just general blocks? If you wanted to update a block through this interface, does that need to be supported?
It's really, I mean, what dynamic data really just provides is largely a pipeline. So if you have your own custom data types and you have controls that can understand those data types, they can work together.
So you just have to create a field template which did something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so the last thing I need to do is jump back to my class here, which is this guy. And then just add one last little snippet here. Now the key here is I'm actually using a different attribute. This attribute is a UI hint. This is the way I tell the data model to go and, or the dynamic data to go and use this particular user control to render this particular field. And again, I've added that user control here. So let's hit play. Hopefully that worked for us. And we'll jump into our categories. Voila, we've got images. Now, not only do these images exist here, but they also exist in the details view again, because we're pulling from that same data model. Okay, so that's kind of the extent of what I wanted to show in terms of customization. To give you an idea of what's actually possible, let me flip over to a completed app. And I won't bother adjusting the fonts. Let me just run it and kind of show you what we've done here. Essentially, you know, we've looked at things like, let's see, we can edit here. We've looked at using like the Telerik slider control here for doing integers. We've used the Telerik calendar control for doing editing of dates. So we've got that here as well. We've used that kind of Big Daddy RAD text editor for editing categories. Edit here. And I get things like spell check and all the great stuff that this control provides me. So again, I can really customize my website to...
Sam, do you want to show a field template for one of those things that's using the Telerik stuff?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, was that last one a Telerik control?
Yes.
It's their rich text.
Yeah, so let me jump into the Telerik rich text here. That's this guy. And we'll take a look at this user control. So, you know, not too complicated here, right? We're not doing too much. It's basically a user control like any other user control. And the last thing that I wanted to show here is I've actually added some custom validation logic here. Now, there was a question about, you know, handling events and, you know, what to do while the user is interacting with the page. Here what I've done is I've handled the partial on category name changing method, and I've said throw a new validation exception. If that particular value, the new value doesn't start with same. So if we jump back to hit play here, instead of breakpoint, we jump into categories. If I edit beverages, for example, and it doesn't start with Sam, as I hit update, our breakpoint will fire here, and we'll shoot off a new validation exception. And you can see here that it has all of the UI already done for me. In the same way that I had the attribute validation, I can do my own custom validation as well.
Is there any support for concurrency issues?
Concurrency, you mean at the data level? So the default model for both linked entities and linked to SQL is just optimistic concurrency, and you get events that fire when there are exceptions on that. If you want to do something richer, you've kind of got to plug into, there are events when the thing's being updated that you can kind of go and plug into.
That's all built right in.
Yeah, and that functionality, that's part of the entity framework, and you can kind of go and plug in at that level.
Yes, question back.
How do you secure the entities, like the people that are on our
advantage? So you're saying if such and such person wants to, you want to limit one of these operations to something?
Yeah, based on your.
So all of the routes in ASP.NET routes actually works with the ASP.NET authorization system. So you can actually go create individual authorization rules for any of those actions. And then the if you want to do more programmatic checking of roles or things like that, you can go ahead and plug those in at the business operation level. So they're like category, just because it happens to be on the screen, you could have an on-updating method on category, a partial method that gets called when you update a category. And at that point, you could do some programmatic security checks on the current user to make sure that they're actually able to do that. And if you throw an exception, it'll kind of come back. But if you want to do it at a higher level where it kind of integrates with ASP.NET's UI, you can also put in a layer there where you're using our authorization system.
Now, one thing I did want to show here, there was a gentleman asked a question about customizing at the entity level. So here what I've done, the last kind of piece of the dynamic data folder is this custom pages section. So what we've done is we've created a new folder for suppliers, this is an entity, and we've dropped in a new version of the list details template. And if we fire this guy up, we can see that, when we hit our suppliers, we actually have this nice little kind of modal dialog that pops up here. And again, this is just a customization of that list details template. This is kind of an Ajax example little thing here.
And today, this is really more of a page template rather than an entity template. And V2 will have entity templates as well, so that you can have pages that combine multiple entities.
And if I wanted to do that on a different entity, I can just change the folder.
Could you provide any guidance for when you want, I guess, you know, virtually everyone who's written ASP.NET web applications are almost always going to get data, displaying data, doing whatever. Is this now the way to do things like that, or is there some, can you give us some guidance as to when you want to use this model versus maybe a more traditional?
I think this will work really more in applications where you're working with the data itself, and where the volume of data that you're navigating or searching over or editing is fairly high. If your application is really based more on kind of an experience first kind of approach, where it's like if I was building a photo gallery, I might actually build that with this system, because photo galleries, even though it doesn't sound like it, it's really just navigating over some data and doing edits. If on the other hand I'm building something that's more of a an e-commerce experience where I'm working with shopping carts and moving things around, that you might want to kind of go more from a storyboard, UI storyboard kind of approach, and then turn that into a UI workflow where you're working with that. What's interesting is you saw this for an entire site, but this functionality is actually composable into your regular sites. So there's, for example, the dynamic validator. You can use that on an ordinary vanilla page and basically just say, hey, let's go point at this entity, and it's just going to pick up the validations from those entity and apply them. And you can do that without using any of the other features.
So you have a hybrid. This is essentially ASP.NET,
and so
like, this way you want. Yeah. Absolutely.
So for example, if you've got a SharePoint site, you might not model the entire SharePoint site as dynamic data, and you probably couldn't because of limitations of web parts. But if you wanted to have one web part that lets you navigate over some data, you could just go and throw some dynamic controls in there and go with that.
Okay, so let's kind of move along here. We've talked a lot about dynamic data. We've showed how we can very quickly build these data-driven websites. Now, what if I want to take that same data model and I want to use it in a different application? Well, I can do that by making use of the ADO.NET data services technology. I'll do that by adding a new item here. I'll say ADO.NET data service, and I'll call this thing Northwind data service. I'll hit add. And again, much the same way that I had to hook up the data model to my website, I just have to hook it up here by specifying which entities I want to expose, and just by giving the type here to the template. And just like that, I've got a service that I can play with in the browser. Now, this is a REST-style service. So those of you guys building kind of Web2 applications should be pretty familiar with REST-style apps. Let me just select the service. Now, the nice thing is I can navigate my entities through the browser. So for example, I can take a look at categories by typing in categories here. And I can see all the different categories that I have. Now remember, we added that picture field. Well, here's the binary data that we pulled from the database in that picture field. So again, any of the changes that we made are applied here as well. And now I can do lots of different things here. I can look at a specific category. So I can say category one. And this I get back only the single category, or the first item in that table, if you will.
And this is actually an Atom feed, so you could even technically subscribe to this in your RSS browser.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. If you're just about the data, you could... Sorry, the question?
Yeah, does this have security? Where's the security model for this service?
Just just like you would in terms of hiding columns, you can basically go apply attributes to your... To your types and your properties.
Right. So it's all based off of the...
It's the same data model. That's the key. Yeah. So that's actually the beauty here. I've specified the kind of the business rules once, and then I can use them both in my service and in my website.
You're saying that dynamic data, metadata attributes that you were showing before actually...
So remember...
The entity model.
Those were entity model attributes. Right. So I was actually adding attributes to the data model, mm-hmm. and dynamic data was picking those up. And my point is, not only will dynamic data pick those up, Astoria or the Adionaut data services
That was my exact question.
There's basically two layers of metadata, if you will. There's some stuff that entity model defines, and Adionaut data services picks that up today. On top of that, dynamic data then pipelines that metadata, and then there's more metadata it adds.
Okay.
We're working on pipelining.
So some of it's generic to the entity framework, and some of it's specific to dynamic data.
Exactly.
So I can actually shape this data any way that I like. So here I have a listing of all my customers. But for example, if I wanted to order my customers, I can do that by typing order by equals to contact name. Notice that contact name is one of the fields I have here. And so what you should see is that the customers will now be ordered by alphabetic order, by the contact name. That makes sense because we have Alejandra, and after Alejandra we have Alexander, and so on and so forth. Now, I can take that even a step further. I can specify that I want to skip a few of these things. So I can say, and skip equals to 2.
And when you're all done with that, can you paste that URL into Notepad and set the font size for you?
Unfortunately,
I guess you'd have to change your Windows fonts. Do you have the zoom in tool?
Yeah. Oh, not on this machine. I have it on my other machine, sorry. It's
the coolest tool.
No, because that URL really is code in a way, so.
So what I've done here is I've skipped the first two and I've taken the top 10, right? So you can see how I can shape my data. Let me grab that, put it in, I can put it in Word maybe. That might help.
Actually, you can also use accessibility
tools on the microphone.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah. That actually has a
magnifier. Okay, so hopefully that'll help here. As you can see that I've got running a localhost on this port. I've got order by, skip, and top 10.
We hope that you've enjoyed this presentation. Please let us know what you think by dropping me email or posting to my blog at the address shown. Thanks for watching.